Welcome to Macquarie University's new storytelling podcast, Leading Lights, where we showcase the world-changing research that's happening on Macquarie University's campus every single day. Whether it's astrophysics or astronomy, or leading cancer research, we talk to the pioneering minds tackling some of the world's biggest challenges in science, technology, health, the economy, environment, and more. You can listen to this story and find many others about how Macquarie Uni's researchers are making a difference at the Lighthouse website at lighthouse.mq.edu.au. My name is Sean Britton, and right now I'm speaking with Ingrid Pillar, Professor of Applied Linguistics at Macquarie University and founding editor of the popular sociolinguistics blog and research portal Language on the Move at languageonthemove.org. Ingrid, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Sean.
Certain members of the Australian government claim we are seeing more and more migrants with little to no English language skills. Is there any truth to this?
Well, there is, in the sense that we are seeing more and more migrants. Australia has had a very large migration intake and has increased its migration intake over the past couple of years or decades, almost since the 1990s. And the more migrants you have from non-English speaking backgrounds, the more of them will also have little or no English, obviously. So in absolute numbers, the number of people, of migrants who don't speak English very well certainly has increased. However, we need to consider that this is part of the overall increase in the migration intake. And considering that the migration intake has increased as much as it has, the percentage of migrants with little or no English has actually gone down, because the Australian migration system since the 1990s has been extremely selective. Most migrants come in as skilled migrants. They come in from middle-class backgrounds, and they have very high levels of education, including very high levels of English. So the vast majority of migrants come in with very good English. That's a condition of their receiving a visa. And it's a smaller group, particularly in the family reunion stream and the humanitarian intake, where we don't actually already have an English requirement in place. And those might be people who, some of them speak English very well too, but some of them don't. And these are the number of people that we are looking at when we are saying, oh, that number is increasing.
How is the English proficiency of migrants currently assessed?
In order to get a visa, you usually have to take a test, standardized test like the IELTS, for instance. And in order to get points towards your visa, you need to take that particular test. And that's why I'm saying most people have a very high level of English. But then when members of the government talk about that fewer and fewer or the number of migrants who don't speak English is increasing, they are actually referring to data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics, from the census data. And in the census, people self-assess. So there is a question on the census, how well do you speak English? So the first language question is, do you speak a language other than English at home? And if you tick that box and add whatever language it is, then you are directed to another question where you're asked to self-assess your English. And you have four options. You can say, I speak English very well, I speak English well, I don't speak English well, I don't speak English at all. And so this form of assessment is called self-assessment. It's obviously highly subjective, and some people will over-assess and say, yeah, my English is, you know, I speak English very well, even if you might sort of disagree when you talk to them, whereas others might be more humble and less inclined to brag, and they might underestimate and say, oh, no, I don't speak English very well, although in fact they do.
There are certainly aspects of social cohesion that we talk about when we say all Australians should understand a common language. But why is this such a hot-button political issue?
I think there is no doubt about the fact that English is important and that in order to thrive in Australian society as an individual and for us all as a society, that you need to speak English and that you need to speak English well. And I think there is probably no single migrant out there who does not understand the importance of English. However, sometimes our politicians like to suggest that there are actually people who have this kind of resistance to learning English. And what they implicitly suggest is that whether you speak English well or whether you don't, that is a matter of personal choice. However, if you come to Australia as an adult with very little English, whether you speak English well or not may only be partially your choice, because not every adult is successful in learning a second language. And in Australia, I think sometimes we're not very good at kind of grasping the enormity of the task of learning another language, because so few native-born Australians have actually had the experience of having to learn another language to a very high level and to function, you know, in that other language on a daily basis, day in and out. So they often think, oh, it's not that difficult. But for some people, it actually is, particularly if you come in as an older person, maybe with very little prior education. Maybe you've experienced trauma. Maybe you're just busy needing to make a living and, you know, working a daily job, and you don't have all that much time to learning. And so there is a segment of older migrants who may never learn English very well. And I think as a society, we need to recognize that and not pretend that, you know, it's just easy like that to learn English. And we need to support them.
Parallel communities. Would you mind explaining to us what these are?
The idea behind parallel communities is that is basically the idea of segregation, that people segregate along lines of linguistic borders or ethnic divisions. And it's certainly something that we have seen in societies around the world, that some migrant groups end up being segregated in particular areas, finding it very difficult to enter the mainstream and finding it very difficult to get ahead. And so that is the threat of the idea that migrants come in and from one generation to the next, they don't actually learn English, they don't join the mainstream, they are stuck in disadvantaged neighborhoods. Now, have we seen that in Australia? Not really, not with the migrant population. We certainly have disadvantage in the Indigenous population, but we haven't seen the transmission of disadvantage in the migrant population. Australia, with the post-war migration, has been very, very successful in actually integrating migrants, and it has created something that's been called the new multicultural middle class. So the children of the post-war migrants and their descendants have done well and are part of the Australian mainstream. They're part of Australia.
What kind of patterns, particularly generational patterns, do we actually see in regards to migrants and migrants' relations proficiency in English instead?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really interesting question, and it's one that's very, very well researched, both in Australia with regards to the post-war migrants and in other migrant-receiving societies, such as the US, for instance. The typical pattern of language transmission in migrant families is a tripartite pattern, where the first generation who come in from non-English speaking backgrounds, they are bilingual, they are dominant in their home language, and they learn English additionally to differential levels. So bilingualism with dominance in the home language. In the second generation, so that's the Australian-born generation, their children or children who come here at very young ages, we see the reverse pattern. We still see a pattern of bilingualism, but a bilingualism where English dominates, where English is much stronger, and where the home language may be learned to different levels. by the third generation, the home language completely disappears and everyone's sort of assimilated into English monolingualism. So that's the typical pattern of migrant transmission. One thing where we actually see some changes to this trigenerational pattern is with the newer generation, with the new migrants since the 1990s, where, as I said, we have a different migrant group in the sense that the migrants who come in now are very well educated, are middle class, and have very high aspirations for the education of their children. And those aspirations now increasingly include bilingualism, because over the past couple of decades, a lot of research has emerged, and that research has really gone out and is very well understood by parents that there is an advantage to being bilingual. You know, you can get better jobs, you can be more mobile, you sort of have an advantage in terms of being able to speak to more people, in being able to understand different cultures, mediate between different cultures. And because that is so, more and more parents are actually trying to keep their home language going in the second generation along with English, support strong bilingualism. And where that is headed, we don't quite know yet, although Australia typically has been, this is a quote for the US, but Australia is similar, it has been a graveyard of languages.
Well, just you mentioned the word mediation there and how bilingualism is an asset. You can certainly see in a very straightforward way how bilingualism might be an asset in day-to-day personal life. But you've also mentioned it as an asset for building and strengthening communities. Mm. Would you mind expanding on that?
Mm-hmm. So bilingualism has a range of advantages. I think the most obvious one is that it can have an economic advantage. For instance, a study, a large-scale study conducted in the US has looked at who in the second generation of migrants has the highest earnings. And it turned out that bilingual children, so when they were young adults, had an earning advantage of around $3,000 per annum if they could speak and, crucially, read and write the home language very well. That advantage held particularly for Chinese. And it was the weakest for Spanish. So this shows us a number of things about, you know, which languages are economically strong, which languages there are more speakers. If you have more speakers of Spanish in the US, for instance, it's not so valuable as if you have fewer Chinese English bilinguals. So it has it can be an economic advantage. However, it can also be it has a strong community advantage in that bilingualism builds connections across generations. And going back to this original question of, you know, how does language divide or bind a society? How is it related to social cohesion? All societies, all strong societies are made up by families. And strong families make strong societies. Now, if you interrupt language transmission in a family, you actually weaken the family. So, for instance, if you have a situation where the migrant parents are dominant in their home language and the children are dominant in English, and you don't have that link of bilingualism, so the parents' English is weak and the children's home language is weak, then that really impedes the ability of parents to be effective socializing agents, to help their children kind of navigate the complexities of growing up in a new society and fitting in. So, the same is true if grandchildren can't talk to their grandparents. That weakens the family, it weakens the community, and implicitly, those grandparents, those parents have a harder time guiding their children well, keeping them out of trouble, and that overall weakens society. Conversely, if you have those bilingual bridges and those strong bilingual families, you also have stronger societies.
As a linguist, what would you recommend so we can ensure widespread English language proficiency in multicultural Australia without ending up with that situation you mentioned before of the graveyard of languages?
That's a really hard question. In terms of ensuring English proficiency for all, we have done very, very well. As I said, pretty much everyone in the second generation is English dominant. So our schools work in that way. They work in socializing migrant children into high levels of English proficiency. And that's fantastic. And we have a very strong record there. Australia actually also has a very strong record in terms of teaching adult migrants, the first generation English. Since the since the late 1940s, Australia has continuously funded the Adult Migrant English Program, which actually is a federally funded program to help migrants learn English if they come in with little or no proficiency in English. So in terms of teaching English, we've done well. And I think all we need to do is keep up that good work, continue to fund the Adult Migrant English Program, continue to have strong language support in schools, and that really will ensure English, because English is just so dominant. Where we haven't been all that successful is actually in supporting the maintenance of the home language. So, as you say, we've become that graveyard of languages. And there we really need to think about ways. How can we do better? How can we actually ensure that children who come in with home languages that they've learned prior to coming to school, that these are actually maintained and supported in the school system so that children learn how to read and write in those other languages? Because that's really what gives you a potential advantage if you learn another language to an academic level. And there we have some work to do in the school system.
Ingrid, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot, Sean. It's been a pleasure.